From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, as he prepares to retire, NPR's Robert Siegel reflects on hosting NPR's All Things Considered for 30 years.
The job really isn't about being everybody's favorite media star. It's about telling people what's going on in the world. And that can be charming, and it can be friendly, and it can also be disturbing. You know, that comes with the territory.
Later, we'll examine the past 12 months in environmental news and look at how physical education has evolved in modern middle schools.
It's trying to change the stigma of just gym. It's physical education. There is education happening. It's just, if you say it's physical education, I think it switches their gears into, you know, this is actually a class.
And a spirited defense of an ice-cold Milwaukee winter. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. NPR's Robert Siegel will host his last edition of All Things Considered tomorrow. Siegel has been hosting the flagship news magazine program since 1987 and has been with the network for more than 40 years. Siegel announced last April that he would step down from the host chair and leave his full-time career as a journalist.
His interviews and stories in four-plus decades at NPR have covered everything from the fall of communism in Eastern Europe to The Simpsons. Before he hosts his last edition of All Things Considered, he joined us from the NPR studios. Robert Siegel, it is a true pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for inviting me, Mitch. It's my pleasure.
And are you at the point where you are thinking that, you know, this is the last time I'll see this, or this is the last time I'll have to do that?
Yes, that's been happening for quite a while, and it's sort of odd. But yes, I'm thinking about last things happening these days.
Can you reflect on the kind of place NPR was when you first walked in the door?
Well, it was much smaller than it is today, and it was younger, I'd say. People often forget, we now have a beautiful headquarters in Washington, D.C., but the building that I came to in NPR, when I came to work at NPR, was two buildings ago. And the three studios that we had were, I think, the most beautiful radio studios I had ever seen. And I'd already worked in radio for 6-7 years, something like that. It was very well equipped. It was full of lots of bearded people. it was a place where people were actually trying to put the program on the air. There was only one daily program to speak of, All Things Considered. And the idea was to put a program on the air that we would listen to, which may sound on one level self-evident, but it's kind of fighting words to an audience researcher who would tell you, well, you're not reaching the right demographic if you don't. But I think the sincerity of the place was what struck me more than anything else, and the idealism of it, that we could actually do radio journalism the way we thought it should be done, not the way we figured you have to do it in order to succeed in a tough marketplace, and that if it was the show that we would all find very interesting, there must be a few hundred thousand other people like us out there, and I think we were right.
This was 1976, I think.
End of 76, yeah.
Yeah. Did you and the others who were there, the other bearded people, see the network as the sort of place that you might go to work for 40 years at that point?
When I moved down here, I saw it as a place that was good for about 2 years, is what I thought. And I thought I had left New York City when the radio station I worked at was sold. I figured it would take me a couple of years to work my way back to civilization. And my wife had been very supportive, and she and our one-year-old daughter, we only had one child then, we'd made the trek down to Washington, living in Northern Virginia. It all seemed to me to be an unfortunate detour that I would have to, I'd be able to correct for within a couple of years. And I was utterly seduced by National Public Radio. We didn't shrink from spelling it out in those days. National Public Radio turned out to be a very exciting environment to work to work in.
Well, so flash forward a couple of years, as you look around NPR today, this is a network that is known and respected internationally. What was NPR's reputation when you became the London bureau chief?
Well, we didn't have much of a reputation. I mean, we had won awards for All Things Considered. Susan Stamberg was a great and unusual host of All Things Considered and had made a great impact on those who listened to us. It was only with the launch of Morning Edition that the audience began to multiply as rapidly as it did. When I was in London, I was based at the BBC, and there people had been working together with NPR, so they were aware of who we were and what we did. But when I spoke to ordinary people whom I would meet in London, I would have to explain to them what this thing was. And we just didn't have that that high a profile. But before I'd gone to London, most of the people we called up in the United States for interviews or for bookings of some sort or another would not know what we were exactly, unless it was in Minnesota. they had a dynamic statewide broadcast system, Minnesota Public Radio. And there, everyone from public office holders to baseball players knew what public radio was and what NPR was. But generally, we were just a little thing coming over the horizon.
So was there learning on the job you had to do as this kind of newly minted bureau chief?
I guess, but I was surrounded by 1,000 pretty smart people doing radio. In some ways better than I'd ever seen it done. In other ways, I thought it was kind of odd the way they did things. But it was a tremendous learning experience, and I learned from lots of people around me, and I learned from people whom I'd worked with at NPR in Washington. I was one of two editors after doing 6 months of newscasting, and the other was a guy named Robert Krulwich, who had actually been the friend of a friend who had connected me with NPR in the first place. And he was about the most creative character I had ever worked or have ever worked with ever since. And I learned a tremendous amount about problem solving and how do we think in terms of what kind of stories we'll do and how do we do those stories and when do we say that's not a radio story and when do we say I've got to figure out a way to make that a radio story. So I it was a great rapid learning experience for me.
You were on Fresh Air a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and you talked about your sound when you were a young reporter and anchor, that you were basically trying to sound like someone who was on the radio.
Yes.
Can you pinpoint when you went from that sound to settling into the voice that was really yourself?
I can't. However, my personal obituarist, Melissa Gray, a very gifted producer on All Things Considered, went rummaging through the archives to put a couple of things on the air about my career here. And she has a point somewhere in the late 1990s that she feels my style of speaking on the air changed around that time, which was about 10 years into hosting the program. So I had 10 years of growing up in public on the radio. But I recently, we recently replayed a story that I did about my love of a particular movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, the Allegretto, the second movement. And I think it was from 15 years ago or more. And the tracks were intercut. I did some tracks that I had to update because there were time references in the original story. But some of the voice tracks of mine were there from the original piece. And to my ear, and I can be pretty critical about hearing my own voice, they were indistinguishable. So I was sounding, I think I've sounded pretty much the same for somewhere between 15 and 20 years. And for better or worse, that's what I sound like on the radio.
Let me ask you, as a radio person for the last 25 plus years who has kids, did you ever use your radio voice to annoy your kids?
I don't think I ever did that, or that they would believe me if I did. But I think you're revealing something about yourself, Mitch.
To try to wrestle this back to a somewhat serious tone.
Yes, please, yes, of course. Yeah.
Journalism is in a somewhat different place in society now than it was in 1976 or 1986 or even 1996. What do you make of the era we're in, and does this feel like the right time to get out?
Well, it feels like the right time to get out, not because of the era we're in, but because of the era that I'm in. And that's really driven by my sense of whether I continue doing what I've been doing or do something different or do less or whatever. So it's that's not it. I'm not retiring either because of or despite the era of accusations of fake news. At the moment, it's not just that there are people who mistrust journalists. There have been lots of people who mistrust journalists for years. They have found a leader in the voice of the president, which is kind of odd, but it's a time when the president speaks frequently about how institutions that report things that he doesn't like are faking it and are in some way fraudulent or that their intent is off. And it's different and unlike anything that I can recall from my working life in Washington. But I would add that as for actions against journalists and I would say still journalism institutions, although some would say that an antitrust intervention might prove the contrary.
Sure.
He hasn't done as many things to journalists as Richard Nixon did. That is, he hasn't done the equivalent of starting an FBI investigation of Dan Shore, who later became a colleague and dear friend at NPR. That's what Richard Nixon did. He didn't set out to destroy the Washington Post, as you can hear him saying in the tapes in the movie The Post that's out right now. So Nixon, who bitterly opposed the news media and journalism, actually also did things that were harmful to individuals and I would say to institutions. He smashed public television and prevented it from having a structure like ours, frankly, in radio. So at some level, we've been through worse, the media have. We also should remember that our job, although those of us in broadcasting develop some personal rapport with the people who follow us that's different from a byline in a newspaper and people who read you, the job really isn't about being everybody's favorite media star. It's about telling people what's going on in the world and relating stories about what's new. And that can be charming, and it can be friendly, and it can also be disturbing. That comes with the territory. So I think that the challenge to all of us in the news media is to keep at what we do, to do it very well, to be mindful that there are many people who mistrust us, and to soldier on, be careful to make sure they have no real reason to mistrust us. And do the job. I think the institutions of journalism will outlast the individuals who carp about them.
As you clear off your desk for the last time, is there one most important thing that you will take off of that desk with you as you go into retirement?
I've just been doing this. I've just been clearing off my desk, and I can't tell you the array of junk that I've had on my desk all this time. It would be... it would be very trivial for me to remark on the strange wood-shaped egg cup that's been sitting on my desk for the past 10 years. I don't know why. I actually the coaster I've been using has been from the Milwaukee Rotarians for the past 30 years, from a luncheon that I must have spoken at sometime in the 1980s. I have no idea why it's there. My desk is a tribute to the random nature of life, that many things are accidental and purposeless.
Well, the Milwaukee Rotarians will be honored for the for the shout out, as they say.
it's been there all this time. I don't know whether to take it home with me or bequeath it to one of my colleagues.
Well, Robert Siegel, as I say, this is my 25th year in public radio.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I am sad that it took until your last week of work for me to get to speak with you. But thank you so much for everything you've done for this field and for your time today.
Mitch, thank you very much. And thanks, actually, especially to people who not only listen, but who also support their public radio station. It's a way, in part, of supporting what we do at the network, at NPR News, and it's something that I think all of us who work here appreciate a great deal. So thanks to all of you.
Well, you are honestly, for all of us, a shining beacon of what this field can be.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you.
And best of luck to you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Robert Siegel has been the host of NPR's All Things Considered for 3 decades. His last show at the program will be tomorrow and will end his more than 40-year career at NPR. We spoke with him from NPR studios in Washington, and you can read more about his work at WUWM.com.
We will look back at the last year in environmental news when Lake Effect continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. As we get into 2018, a lot of people use the dawn of the new year to consider what the past 12 months brought to the world. Yesterday on the show, we talked with reporter J.R. Ross about the past year in politics and how it might shape the year to come.
Today, WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz undertakes a similar exercise on her beat. Susan reports that, as was the case with politics, some of the major environmental stories of 2017 will likely show up in the headlines again this year.
Waukesha started the year on a high note. After years of study and applications, Waukesha had taken a major step toward tapping into Lake Michigan to replace the city's radium-tainted well water. The Great Lakes governors had approved the plan. Then, early in 2017, a consortium of U.S. and Canadian mayors tried to stop the diversion. Waukesha won that battle, and the city made a final decision on how it would obtain its new water supply. Waukesha had been slated to purchase and pipe water from Oak Creek, but in late October, leaders changed course and announced a deal with the city of Milwaukee. As the announcement was made, Mayor Tom Barrett admitted that previous attempts at negotiating a deal had been bumpy.
What you had was you did have a policy disagreement, and it was an honest policy disagreement that fortunately the leadership in Waukesha and the leadership in Milwaukee never allowed to cloud our main focus. How can we do right by our residents?
Despite progress, much work remains before Waukesha residents begin to drink Lake Michigan water. Right now, planners are puzzling out exactly where the pipelines will fall. Meanwhile, Milwaukee faced its own drinking water challenges in 2017. The city had long been sharing the message that people living in homes built prior to 1951 were at higher risk of lead exposure in water. The reason? Those older homes likely have lead service lines. The city initially said about 70,000 households were affected. Then last February, city leaders discovered that as many as 10,000 more homes might be on the list. The health department had just set a Lead Safe Milwaukee campaign in motion. It folds in risks both posed by water and paint. Before the campaign launch, the department had also been distributing free water filters with the help of community partners. But a group called the Fresh Water for Life Action Coalition called on leaders to scale up efforts. Robert Miranda is founder of the organization.
Asking the city to begin alerting the public in regards to this concern, begin directing the Milwaukee Water Works to contact water consumers of the city and alert them of the fact that they may have lead pipes. In that contact, provide information that will help them determine if they have lead pipes or not.
In nearly the same breath, another local organization took up the lead issue from a different angle. With representatives from the U.S. Department of Agriculture standing by, Hunger Task Force held a press conference focusing on nutrition. Executive Director Sherry Tussler says kids are better protected from absorbing lead if their diets include vitamin-rich food.
State and local agencies all came together and they agreed that well-fed means less lead and that we can advance this cause in a reasonable way in our community.
The two groups kept up their call for action throughout the year. In response, in late November, the Common Council passed a resolution. It reinforces the importance of informing the public about filtering water to reduce the risk of exposure and testing young children for possible lead poisoning. In years to come, the city will need to tackle the long-range challenge of replacing tens of thousands of lead laterals. The Milwaukee Department of Public Works reported crews will have replaced 600 lines by the end of 2017. Concerns about green space also wove in and out of 2017, including the vast acres managed by Milwaukee County. In Wauwatosa, heated debate remains over the future of a bit of woods, affectionately called Sanctuary Woods. The parcel is surrounded by the ever-expanding research and medical complex that includes children's and freighted hospitals. At one of several meetings this year, Wauwatosa resident Deb Fowler made the case to preserve the 22-acre parcel.
Because we have lost so much of the county grounds, what remains is an oak savanna, some incredible spring ephemerals, a pond with frogs and many species, and it's the last remaining spot.
But Wauwatosa Mayor Kathy Eli insisted public concern is unfounded.
It is my belief that at the end of this planning process, we will have a plan that provides a framework to both protect and conserve beloved green space, as well as provide opportunities and guide decisions that foster economic development, job creation, and added value.
Eli's perspective could be applied to debates at the state level this year. In November, the Republican-controlled legislature passed a bill to end Wisconsin's so-called mining moratorium. For the last two decades, companies hoping to mine for minerals such as gold or copper were required to prove they had already run a non-polluting mine. People pushing for the change argued the bill would allow companies to open job-creating mines more easily. Spooner resident Casey Aronson made his case at a hearing in September. He's a heavy equipment operator and said he would be eager to take one of those jobs.
Not only give us a place to work, but give our children an opportunity to work and live in northern Wisconsin rather than watching them leave to seek employment elsewhere. I love the great outdoors. I, too, want to preserve and protect our land. But I believe that we can safely and responsibly mine our land without harming the environment.
Perhaps no other piece of legislation in 2017 garnered more attention than the Foxconn bill. The sweeping document folded in $3 billion in tax incentives for the Taiwanese manufacturer. It also offered exemptions from environmental permits and DNR oversight as the company builds a huge LCD screen plant in Racine County. During the debate, Jennifer Giegridge with the League of Conservation Voters cited a bundle of concerns. They included the public's inability to weigh in on the gigantic campus's impacts to air and water. Under the bill, Foxconn can offset the impact of disturbing wetlands by building wetlands somewhere else. Giegridge was aghast.
They're literally what filters our drinking water. So any rainwater that comes off a parking lot or comes off a farm field, a wetland is what clears that out before it goes into the groundwater. It's also the major source of flooding protection.
Conservation groups weren't alone in raising concerns. So were Democratic and some Republican lawmakers, including Representative Bob Culp of Stratford. He says his constituents have questions. Culp turned to DNR Deputy Secretary Kurt Thiede for answers.
So let me just kind of cut to the chase. Will the DNR be continuing to monitoring things through the construction process? And when the construction process and the plant is in full operation, will those residents in that area have clean water and clean air?
There's nothing in this bill that rolls back any of the air construction permits that are going to be necessary, air monitoring requirements that are going to be in place, and the standards that are associated with those permits, the stormwater requirements, the waste requirements, and how that's managed.
As Foxconn prepares to break ground in Racine County, critics are likely to once again voice their concerns about the plant's impacts. In recent weeks, lawmakers began debating another bill that would impact Wisconsin's wetlands. State Senator Roger Roth authored a proposal to free up certain wetlands for development. About 80% of the state's wetlands are connected to surface water, such as rivers and lakes, and are regulated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Roth says the bill simply makes better use of the remaining 20% that adds up to about 1 million acres. He says that developers would still be required to improve or create wetlands somewhere else.
This bill doesn't destroy wetland. This doesn't reduce the amount of wetland here in Wisconsin. This is just streamlining that permitting process, and at the end of the day, there will be no net loss of wetlands here in Wisconsin.
On December 21st, a long queue of people testified for and against the bill. One of the opponents was George Meyer, a former DNR secretary and current head of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. He says some of the wetland areas that would be folded into the bill are important ecologically and environmentally. Meyer urged state legislators to form a work group composed of both developers and conservation groups to look at wetlands and proposed projects individually rather than unilaterally removing protection.
There is a willingness by these groups to solve the wetland regulatory issues, but sportsmen and women are united that any such proposal has to be carefully constructed so as not to open the floodgates for loss of the vast majority of non-federal wetlands, which provide valuable habitat, water quality protection, and ever more critical flood damage relief.
We've barely scratched the surface of the environmental issues that were in the news over the last 12 months. You can check out all of our coverage by visiting wuwm.com/environment and follow us in 2018. For Like Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Susan Bentz is WUWM's environmental reporter. You can find all her stories from the past year and other years at wuwm.com.
From the exercise of looking back to the literal exercise that some Milwaukee area middle school students are getting in school, after a quick break, we'll explore the Phi-Ed curriculum one school district is employing and how it compares to the gym class you might remember. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Think about what gym class was like as a kid. You probably played badminton or pickleball. Maybe the prospect of the dodgeball unit sent shivers up your spine. Or maybe you were the kid who always got picked first or last.
Today, your standard gym class experience is changing in a handful of schools around the Milwaukee area. In fact, you can't even call it gym in front of Nancy Bradigan. For her, it's physical education.
Bradigan is the lead PE teacher at Wauwatosa's Longfellow Middle School, and her students no longer simply complete units, basketball one week, football the next.
This morning on WUWM News, we heard how it's up to the kids themselves what activity they do, as long as they're active. Students pass if they reach their target heart rate zone for at least 30 minutes each class period, as measured by wearable heart rate monitors.
Mrs. Bradigan says this change is a growing trend in physical education circles. She met up with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello during class. As her students worked up a sweat, she filled us in on how her district is working to transform gym class into true physical education.
The sixth graders go through each of the activities that they have an option to play in seventh and eighth grade. So we cover all of that. They will get an introduction to the heart rate monitors at the end of the year, but they go through, like, we'll go over pickleball, badminton, volleyball, basketball, hockey, soccer. We do swimming. During sixth grade, they get exposure to all of those so that we know that they have the skills and the movement concepts necessary to then make good choices when they're in seventh and eighth grade and pick things that they feel comfortable and good about doing and should be able to elevate their heart rates up. So yeah, sixth grade is basically the same, like what most people would consider your regular Phi-Ed class. Where in seventh and eighth grade, it's more of a at the club type of deal where you get to, you know, if you have a membership to the WAC and you want to go play basketball, that's what you do for your exercise. Or if you want to go lift weights or if you want to go on the elliptical, it's kind of that same theories that you get to go in, choose and be active and maintain your healthy heart.
Do you think, like, your role has changed as the teacher?
For sure. Yeah, our role has totally changed, which I find encouraging because in Phi-Ed especially, I want to be more of a, like, mentor or facilitator. I think that takes the edge off of class. Now I'm just there to help encourage them and be more of a motivator than, you know, have this barrier up that I have to teach skills and kids are coming in not wanting to do the skills. Now I think we are seen as more a coach in a way, or a mentor, or a facilitator, however you want to put it. The first quarter, we taught them everything they needed to know. So we taught them about the heart rate monitors. We taught them about their target zone. We went through individually and had a couple days of gameplay. Here we're going to play basketball. Choose whatever basketball activity you want to do, just make sure you get to the zone. So they had to then figure out what it is they had to do. Some kids could just shoot around and play lightning. Other kids played a full court basketball game. It kind of depended on, obviously, their maximum heart rate or where their cardiovascular endurance was at the time. So we taught them all those little pieces that they would need to go forward. That was our teacher mode. Now we are more like in a facilitator mode. We facilitate the activity, we monitor them, we walk around, check on them, make sure they know what they're doing. Weight room obviously is a little bit more responsibility to make sure kids are using things responsibly. Our district really wants kids to be independent. They want them to be in charge of their own learning. When we take away the skills and they don't worry about winning, they don't worry about being able to serve correctly, and they just enjoy playing like you would normally, it breaks down those barriers. And they get a choice. It gives them ownership, and it puts the responsibility on them, and they more likely will be more active. And plus, they can be with their friends in the class. Another incentive is I can participate with my friends because they're in the same hour as me. And that allows them to have a social aspect, which we all know if we have somebody who's a friend of ours that's working out with us, we're more inclined to be more active or have somebody to be an incentive to you or help you achieve your goal, I guess you could say.
Your colleague mentioned that not just your role, but like the way your day looks is a little different now. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, more of a administrative duties. The administrative duties is a little bit more because then at the end of class, we write down what their total minutes were for the day so that they don't have to keep track. And then we can also then track the kids and like I've gone and if there's a kid that doesn't have a sensor for multiple days in a row, send an email home, grab the kid the next class and say, what's going on? You don't have a sensor, do you need a strap? You know, these are their report cards basically, or our grade book, so to speak. It's kind of taken place of, you know, the old school grade book. That way they have an honest file of their workout.
So I know this happened when I walked in. I said I was here for gym and you corrected me and said physical education, FIAD. Have you had to do that with kids and parents too?
I do. I take, it's my thing. I don't know. A lot of my colleagues, they're like, who cares? I'm like, I care. I said, because it's trying to change the stigma of just gym. It's physical education. There is education happening in the classroom. It's just, if you say it's physical education, I think it switches their gears into, you know, this is actually a class. It's a meaningful class that we are trying to educate kids. Kids say it, and I'm like, oh, physical education. I do it with my own kids. And it still happens, but I will always correct people. Well, it's my profession, too. You know, to me, it gives it a little bit more clout if you say it's a physical education class. And because, you know, a lot of people have that perception of it's just gym. Well, I don't want that to be the perception here at Longfellow or in TOSA in general. I want kids and parents and the community members to understand that we are here educating your student lifelong, that we are not just a regular gym class, so to speak.
So it sounds like it's happening in TOSA, it's happening in South Milwaukee. Is this something that you see is happening all over the place?
I would say yes. When we had our area meeting with all the FIAD teachers, I would say 90% of the schools that go to that meeting have now adopted some sort of heart rates technology. But yeah, it's definitely flourishing in Wisconsin. Nationally, I would assume it is because the technology has been around for a while. So it's been around, it's been used, but I don't think it's been necessarily used in this context. It's a choice in making sure they understand which activities can, you know, elevate their heart rates. Instead of just, you know, oh, now we're doing a fitness unit, you're going to wear the heart rate monitors. They're using them every single day so that they have feedback every single day. That's different. That I know is different. I think it's a good step. I mean, everybody wants to use technology anyways, so why not embed it in classes that you can? And a lot of the schools, I know in Southeast Wisconsin especially, are definitely moving towards this because it's what's best for kids. It really is. It gives them a little bit more of a lifelong knowledge than just, oh, let's teach you how to play basketball. I don't like basketball. Too bad. Got to do it anyways. It's part of our curriculum. You know, it takes that all out of the picture, so. Yes.
So if you had to phrase how you're changing FIAD and how it's changing how kids are learning, how would you describe that?
Oh, that's twofold, because they are learning lifelong skills. They're learning to be more responsible about themselves. Like, this is on them. They have to monitor themselves. So they're becoming independent learners. And that is a change, because in education in the past, it's been a lot of teacher stands in front of the room, gives them the information, they spit it back out. Here, we're giving them tools to access the information, and they have to use those tools independently to receive their own education, I guess is how I would phrase it. And then technically, What we're doing as a whole child is what kids don't realize is if they get 20 to 30 minutes of cardiovascular activity in their zone on a daily basis, they have now increased their ability to learn. There's science behind, you know, the more oxygen to your brain, the synapses start firing faster. So whatever class they have after Phi Ed, more often than not, they should be more alert. They should be more receptive to learning. And also, obviously, when kids are healthier, there's less behavior problems. Their social and emotional health is improved. So technically, we're not just giving them a different academic experience. We're hoping that when they realize the benefits that they're getting that are outside of class, that encourages them to be, you know, more in tune to being active outside of class, thinking, oh, great, if I just take a 20-minute walk, I feel better. You know, I don't feel stressed or I don't feel as sad or something along those lines. So I think Phi Ed is changing a little bit to be obviously more independent learners and then having that outside effect on education and social and emotional health.
Nancy Bradigan is a physical education teacher at Wauwatosa's Longfellow Middle School. She spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello, and you can hear sounds from Mrs. Bradigan's 7th grade phys ed class on our website, wuwm.com.
One more break, and then one essayist explains why the Arctic weather is actually a great excuse to get outside in Milwaukee, plus an art exhibit celebrating 100 years of the Wisconsin State Capitol. We'll hear more when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM.
More of Lake Effect Now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You don't need us to tell you that it's cold outside. When the thermometer reads 5 below or even 5 above, sometimes it can be hard to get up the motivation to go outside. But Lake Effect essayist Eric Hansen explained back in 2009 that there are some compelling reasons to get outside when it is so cold out. And it's a message that bears hearing again.
Lake Michigan is a flash of beauty in our daily lives. Glass-like and calm one day, raging with storm surge waves the next. The lake is a sweeping spectacle, our shoreline, the front row seats. Time spent practicing the fine art of Lake Michigan gazing is rarely a loss, but as winter sets in, the curtain rises on the lake's finest treats. Truth is, it would be reasonable for the Park District to erect an event sign along Lincoln Memorial Drive in late fall. Notice, the year's most outstanding landscape art exhibit will fill our eastern horizon for the next several months. Memorable panoramas of clouds, waves, and brilliant low-angle sunlight, exotic wildlife visitors from afar, shoreline ice formations and drift ice offset by water-tinted a zillion shades of aqua, and sky tones ranging from mauve to electric blue, a compelling narrative of time and place. Kindly pull over and park for best and safe viewing. Even after watching the lake show for years, it can stun with surprises. Perhaps none is as striking as the dark wall of clouds, like a vast mountain range that arose overnight, that appears to our east the morning after the season's first cold front crosses the lake. Meanwhile, closer inshore, hundreds of bufflehead ducks, recent arrivals from the far north, bob and dive in the waves. The males, as handsome as emperor penguins, are elegant in their tuxedo suits. As the morning sun tops the cloud bank, the buffleheads acquire a flashy sheen and a swath of shimmering reflection stretches across the water towards the southeast. That direct sunlight is a vivid reminder that the lake is my favorite setting for enjoying the winter sun. I savor the winter sunlight, both for its light therapy and its sheer dazzling brilliance in the dry air. Better yet, the winter sun spends long hours acting as a low-angle spotlight, creating the dramatic lighting photographers call golden light. That light show and the lake scene hit a crescendo late on an early winter afternoon as the sun's rays parallel the Bradford Beach shoreline. Shadows deepen and spread across the shoreline sand to the water's edge. Just offshore, the foaming waves and wheeling gulls turn a brilliant incandescent white in the late light, stark contrast against the dark backdrop of the mid-lake cloud bank. Then, one by one, the waves lose their brightness. Finally, only the farthest white caps and the highest gulls retain their luster. That early season show only gets better as winter arrives in force. North winds bring increasing odds that the ultimate wild card, a knockout of a visitor from the Arctic known as the snowy owl, will show up. I had no trouble spotting one of these great white hunters that was putting in regular hours at the McKinley Marina several years back. His plumage was smooth as could be, a royal white cape that matched his regal pose as he perched on a breakwater boulder. Now and then his head would pivot so far it was eerie. Friends who were on their way home from a concert late one evening stopped by to look for this raptor. Just as the single-digit temperatures were about to persuade them to leave, the snowy owl emerged from the dim half-light at the pier's end. More of a ghostly apparition than a bird, the owl glided past them, a rodent dangling from its talons. Snowy owls may be a scene stealer, but they aren't the only midwinter superlative in these parts. Frigid temperatures bring an abundance of ice, and the lake acquires a bold new dimension. There is a daydreamy ebb and flow to the wanderings of pack ice. These large slabs, accumulating near our shore when east winds blow, seem to offer a fresh canvas every morning, as if a giant artist's paintbrush of breeze and current had spent the night sketching arcs and other formations. Viewed from the heights of our lakeside bluffs, the drift ice reveals another quality, nature's own light meter, registering the deep blue of the water in the afternoon, rosy in the ever-changing planes of light at dawn. Below the bluffs and their broad panoramas, a fantasia-like microworld of turrets, ridgelines, and blowholes forms as shore ice builds. Storm surge waves deposit layer after layer, a frozen diary of the season's rowdy weather. Nearby, small chunks of lake ice add their wind chime tinkle to the soundtrack as they ride the swells. Milwaukee is a place of concert halls and snowy owls, art museums, and ice floes. Just east of our town's tall buildings is a shoreline where timeless panoramas unfold each winter. Along that shore and out on the big lake, the far north visits. Catch that sparkling magic before it's gone.
Milwaukee writer Eric Hansen reading his essay, which first aired 9 years ago this week.
Last year focused on the centennial of Wisconsin's state capitol. But rather than focusing on the building, Madison artists Brenda Baker and Bird Ross chose instead to focus on a statue that's been greeting and encouraging the women of Madison since late 1895. Funded by women across the state, the statue called Forward was sculpted by Jean Pond Minor and holds court at the Capitol's east entrance.
For Ross and Baker, Forward is the inspiration for Being Forward, a photographic installation at the Playhouse Gallery in Madison's Overture Center. The work features over 100 photographs of Wisconsin women artists and supporters, including Radio Chipstone contributor Jennifer Fields. The goal of the exhibition is to recognize the contribution of women to the arts and to create the Women Artists for Forward Fund, which supports female artists in Wisconsin.
The exhibition runs for one more week. In this encore edition of Radio Chipstone, Jennifer Fields chats with Brenda Baker and Bird Ross about the project. According to Ross, the inspiration behind the work is multifaceted.
Certainly it comes from more places than I could, you know, really articulate at this moment. I mean, she's really been a real symbol, I think, especially if you think back to January of 2017, during the women's movement, there she was on the Capitol along with everyone else. And so it was obvious to us at that point that she really did carry a lot of energy and a lot of power and a lot of truth for a lot of women. So that was part of it. But also, she was made by a young 28-year-old woman in 1893. And this woman was one of two women chosen to be an artist in residence at the World's Fair and to be in the Wisconsin Pavilion and to do her work there. And so, she really garnered herself a very prominent position in world history by being able to be a woman artist, Jean Ponminer, at this fair in 1893.
And I think that one of the things that happens, Brenda, when we have public sculptures, when we live amongst these things, we forget who they are and we forget their power.
Right.
Am I reaching when I say that that's kind of the condition of the woman artist?
I definitely think there's an invisibility. I mean, if you look at the statistics, many of them that we've gathered from the National Museum for Women's Art in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of statistics that support that. I think 65% of the MFA graduates right now from the universities are women. We know that 3 to 5% of the collections in major galleries around the world are only 3 to 5% are artworks made by women. We know that in terms of positions, jobs in the arts, women make less than men. You know, there are lots and lots of statistics like this that sort of support the fact that women are less seen and less visible.
Bird, when you think about this and when you look at this project, one of the things that strikes me is that, to be honest with you, there are women up there who are my friends that I know are artists. But I don't think about them being artists until I'm at one of their shows. For me, in my head, it's not part of their identity, and I'm wondering if that's part of the problem.
I think sometimes people are, maybe, I can't speak for all women, but it's tricky to identify yourself as an artist and as a female because of the fact that maybe you're not necessarily taken seriously, or they want to know more about what sort of integrity do you have in your artwork. What is it about you being an artist that makes you someone that I should pay attention to? I mean, I feel like I'm sort of constantly grappling with the way that I should describe myself in a way that people get it, that it makes them curious, and it makes them realize that it's, even though I have a good time doing it, it's a serious business for me.
When I look at this wall and I see these women and I see us all in this pose and you see the objects that they're holding, when you see their tools, there's a woman holding a film camera, there's a woman holding brushes, there's a woman holding a work of art, there's a woman holding a hammer, there's a woman holding a frame, some are holding books, there's a camera lens. It really is this community.
Well, certainly I would say the process of doing this piece for both of us has been really eye-opening, and it's been a great community building process. We've met so many people that we didn't know in the arts community, and I personally felt like I was very well connected in the arts community, but in fact I've realized there are so many people that I don't know whose work I'm not familiar with. So it was really eye-opening in that way, pulling this together, and I do feel like we've created a greater sense of community, at least for ourselves and those who have participated.
So, Bird, when this comes from an idea, when this comes from a statue that we've lived amongst, we've walked by her numerous times, was there a transformative moment when you saw these photos?
Well, I think the beauty of these images, now that they're up and on the wall, is the fact that there is so much variety, diversity that you alluded to before, and how they all are a part of the piece. They are all different, and yet they are all one in a way. And I think it's really fabulous to see a group of women up there who are supposedly dressed as the same, all as the same statue, and yet they bring all of their individual attitude, size, style, background, heritage, work, right into the piece. So we feel lucky that way.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts. You'll find a link to more about the Being Forward exhibit at wuwm.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tine. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.